make it lawful for them. Mm-hmm. And that Islamic contract is, you know, obviously and automatically just temporary marriage. So
yeah,
what are we going to explore about this topic today?
So one dimension that we didn't really talk about and shed much light on was parenting. Mm-hmm. And what happens in this scenario? I do remember we did talk about what happens when there's a child, and that does the child inherit any money?
Yeah.
In the case of temporary marriage. And so we're talking in an Islamic context,
mm-hmm.
We're actually talking in a non-Islamic context, that people who are cohabiting, what happens to them and to their child. I was watching a YouTube video today, and this lady, this researcher, was sharing the result of the paper that she and a co-author had done on what happens to a relationship in the two cases of cohabitation and marriage when a child enters that
picture,
right?
Yep.
And she was saying that 1/4 of cases in cohabiting couples actually break up after the child enters their relationship.
But is that limited to cohabiting couples?
She was actually saying that even in marriages.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. She was addressing that too. But they don't break up after the child enters it, but the quality of the relationship is obviously affected by the child entering it. And she was saying that first she gave this a statistics, and then she was like, okay, so what should we do to tackle this problem? So like much before the entrance of the child into the family, the parents have to prepare themselves they have to learn the strategies and the skills and the tactics to be able to manage their relationship, you know, to know like that they have to prioritize their relationship and to put some time, some quality time, some talking time, some alone time, some going out time together. And, you know, there are some options. But then the point that attracted me and astonished me was that 1/4 of the cases in cohabitation couples, they actually break after that child. And so we're just facing the situation of single moms.
Sad.
And single dads, right? More single moms than single dads, of course.
Yeah.
And so the story of a child entering a cohabitation in 25% of the times would lead to a single mom.
Sad.
Right.
That's devastating. It sucks for the mom, sucks for the kid.
Yeah, imagine like she feels that she has no support.
Yeah, obviously.
And she has a broken relationship. She is like, you know, after a pregnancy and the childbirth, the depression, the postpartum depression
blues, yep.
Yeah, that she's experiencing is coupled with her own grief of the loss of a relationship.
And the whole financial aspect of
exactly.
it, I think, is the most difficult
exactly.
part.
Exactly. So that's just the emotional and the, as you said, the financial part, which is so much affecting the psychological state of her being in this world.
The stress.
And how she can be a mother to her child, you know.
Detrimental, yeah.
Because then one of the most important things, because we have like different degree of needs, and the first need that we have is to basic needs.
Yeah,
to shelter, food and clothing, right?
Yeah.
And when she has
Where does oxygen go in that? I'm so sorry.
That's like taken for granted. I think they should bring it in.
It should be the first need.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
You know, in countries where do not support the family and they don't care to support the family, they are doing all their best to take care of the needs of a woman. You know, whether she's in a family or not, to take care of some of the needs that she has.
To sort of prove that, look, honey, you don't need a man.
Exactly.
Anyway.
It's actually better. I heard that the amount of taxes that is on a family is much more than on individuals living in that country. Okay? Mm-hmm. So if you're married, you're like, you have to pay more to the government than when you're single. with
their
child.
It's really funny, though. I mean, like, what objective are they trying to achieve by doing this?
I was doing some research to find out, like, statistics for what happens to parenting or, like, mothering or fathering after, you know, in a cohabiting couple. And I came about so many interesting things that I didn't know until now. For instance, in one YouTube video, it was talking about shared co-parenting, where just like dating apps or dating sites that you sign up to find someone, you know, to enter into a romantic relationship. There are sites, this was America, like 3-4 sites that you sign up, you're single. If you're like in your late 30s, because it's interesting, Lizaina, this is a point that I've been like mentioning on so many occasions, that this life, this capitalist life has driven us to the direction where us women, because we have a certain period for fertility.
Obviously.
And like the latest would be in our 40s, like early 40s. That would be like the latest, right? And then, first of all, we're studying hard, you know, to find a degree. And then after that, we're looking super hard to find a job. Then we have, in order to achieve and to accomplish good status in that job, to get promotions, you will have to put a lot of your energy and everything that you would have to put of yourself to, in order to be successful in that business. And then your salary is very important to you. Your social status is very important to you. So you prefer not to get married.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, life drives you to the direction that you don't have any other. You don't even find the time. You don't even find the chance to get married, right?
Yeah.
So you stay single. And then you're 35 and you had
And your
dreams.
Biological clock is tick, tick, tick.
Exactly. Mm. And you have dreams, Zainab, of being like you, when you were in your teens, you were like, oh my God, in my future life, I'm going to be a married woman with 3 children and this and that. I will have this house and, you know, a happy family, child running around my home. Mm. This is the picture that you have in your mind, right? And it doesn't happen. So the solution to what that they have come up with is co-parenting. How?
Yeah.
You have your partner. I'm single. I'm a single woman.
Uh-huh.
I'm 36.
Right.
And I'm my dream of having a child is still not satisfied.
Fulfilled, yeah.
So I find you on this website,
app,
on this place. And then we start chatting.
Mm-hmm.
Our profiles are introduced to us. And it takes a year for us to get to know each other.
Mm-hmm.
And then what is the concern of these people who sign up in this website is that they want to be parents.
Mm.
They want to co-parent and child. They're living their own lives. But then because both of them at some point wanted to have a child, so they come together, they might be living together. I was like, oh my God.
I feel like for a person who doesn't have a deep understanding, not that I'm saying I do, but for a society that doesn't have a deep understanding of the human psyche.
They think that they have a very deep understanding.
Yeah, exactly. And the value of human values, you know, its position in our life, its status, its contribution to our sound and not abnormal development. To them, this is like groundbreaking. Right? To them, this is like, oh my God, we've advanced so much as a species.
Problem solved.
Problem solved. We are so civilized that we're able to just get together, reproduce. Everyone wins in this situation. Nothing selfish, no hard feelings, no drama, no trauma. But then this is like messed up that exists.
Let me give you another case.
Dang.
This lady, and this is in America, of course.
Yep.
I don't know if other like European countries have this program or not, but this other lady, she was co-parenting with another very old guy. He was in his 70s, early 70s, and she was in her early 40s.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so like 30 years of difference between them. She had a friend, and she had a son from that friend.
Okay.
Okay, so she was a mother of a child. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like she hadn't had a child. She already had one, but then she wanted another one. Mm-hmm. So she decided to co-parent with this guy. And she said that I was looking for the best match for my purpose. And I found him and they were actually living together. I thought that most probably she has a relationship outside of this relationship where she has a boyfriend because she doesn't have a husband, right? Yeah. So she has a boyfriend. She's having her needs with him. And then she probably brings in the guy to her house. Like her daughter sees him, and then her daughter also sees this guy, this old guy, as the father, the biological father. And I was just imagining how much analysis, how hard it is for the child to understand the complexity of the relationship that her mom is having.
Mm.
And because, Zainab, we as grown-ups, we as adults, we've been wired somehow to grasp everything that our parents do in our childhood. It just wires up in our memory, in our brain, and we take them as their role models. And
what I wanted to say.
We do exactly the same as they do once we grow up.
At the end of the day, that part of God that's been entrusted within us, the part where he says in the Quran, نَفَخْتُ فِيهِ مِنْ رُوحِي, I blew a part of my soul into this clay figure in order to give it life, that part is going to go so restless after a while. And it's going to try to struggle so hard to break free that people and societies and communities and maybe these few next generations that we're so worried about, they're going to be so fed up with all this nonsense. They're going to be like, enough is enough.
They're going to be the pioneers of going to the Deen of Hanif.
Exactly. And they could be the ones who create the groundwork for the reappearance of Sahib al-Zaman. That was interesting. And that was all the time that we have for today's episode. Thank you so very much for joining us. Until another salam, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something. Something to happen to me. But this waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Yani?
Bazaar. Fire clay is basically mud, but a lighter, stickier type of mud with high alumina content. It's actually everywhere around us, but cannot be seen until it is uncovered from the earth. In its raw form, fire clay is found near or between layers of coal in coal mines. People have been extracting it from the ground for millennia to make bricks, ceramicware, tools, homes, and a whole bunch of other things. Its qualities get even better when it's baked and stiffened. This clay has a great number of industrial uses and lasts nearly forever.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. This week, we're going to venture through the vast world of fire clay and its byproducts. We will take a look at where it comes from and why it is so important to several industries that make our lives hum. We also want to understand just how this item fits into the bigger picture of the national economy. So let's start the show.
Thank you.
Our quest for answers led us to a company that owns and manages at least 5 mines in Fars province. Esteghlal Abade Company specializes in the extraction of fire clay and the production of clay products. Fire clay is a refractory material that can withstand extremely high temperatures without losing its original properties. There are other types of refractories that this company also produces in small amounts, such as high alumina and melite ceramics. But its main claim to fame is the production of highly useful fire clay. It might be interesting to know that this company is not just a mine owner. It also has 3 factories. These factories make products like fire brick, washroom items such as sinks, and industrial ceramics. Its production facilities can make large amounts of ceramic parts that are used in various fields such as blast furnaces for coke, iron, and steel productions. Because fire clay is heat-resistant, this material presents excellent qualities for outdoor flooring purposes. One of the benefits is it doesn't crack or expand when exposed to hot climates. That is why it is widely used across the country, particularly in central and southern regions where temperatures can often exceed 45 degrees Celsius. The quality of fire clay is assessed by its levels of impurities. This company can produce some of the highest-grade fire clays in the West Asian region with around 75% purity. In general, when the material is extracted, it is then transferred to the Research and Development Department where it is tested for quality. One of the competitive advantages of this company over similar firms in this field is the quality of its products that match international standards. This holding company has created dozens of direct job opportunities over the years, and hundreds more people are indirectly hired as well. Out of some 50 fire clay mines nationwide, this mine has been the only producer that extracts its products along the lines of exports. This company has faced many challenges over the years to enjoy its many achievements. Some are related to the fluctuation of domestic raw material prices. As part of its future vision, it has also overhauled production processes to optimize outputs. Besides the mine we just talked about, there is one other major fire clay deposit which is located in Charmahal-Bakhtiari province. This mine offers 12 million tons of proven reserves, and it is set to produce some of the best quality refractories in the region. Each year, a combined average of 300,000 tons of fire clay are exported. Iran's tile and ceramic market have become very attractive with rapid socioeconomic development in the West Asian region. Also, there is an increasing need for new housing units in neighboring countries. There are some of the things that are driving Iran's export market in this field. So the country has stepped up its production to gain a larger share of the market. We looked at the latest figures from the Ministry of Industry to gain more insight into the productions in this field. Data showed that in the year 2020, roughly 400 million square meters of tile were produced in Iran. Such productions were estimated to be worth nearly $450 million. These productions were more than local needs, so nearly 160 million square meters of tiles were exported. Industry participants say that this sector is presently operating at only half of its total production capacity, adding that it has high export potential. With this in mind, the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade is working with the government to find ways to expand its markets through production. The goal is to increase production levels by 300 million square meters over the next 4 years. Analysts estimate that this will generate an additional $2 billion in foreign revenues if the strategic sector taps into the full capabilities. Fire clay does not only feed the tile productions. It also supplies raw material to manufacturers of sanitary ceramic ware such as sinks. Iran currently makes copious amounts of these items. In fact, in the first half of last year alone, over 70,000 tons of sanitary ware were released into the market. Going off on information from the National Customs Administration, these items were mainly exported to neighboring countries.
The country's light and heavy construction sector is booming with construction materials in high demands. It is worth noting that domestic raw materials such as fire clay meet 100% of Iran's construction needs. But you don't have to take my word for it. Here are some statistics on the construction materials market.
Iran's steel, cement, tile, and ceramic industries produced more than twice the country's internal needs. Last year, exports of these items raked in some $10 billion in foreign revenues. Tile, glass, and ceramic exports compose some $3 billion of total exports. Steel exports accounted for the rest. That's all based on statistics from the Ministry of Industries, Mining and Trade. On another note, the country's mega mining and metals sector, which also supplies the construction sector, has grown by leaps and bounds in recent years. Industry participants say this was mainly due to the U.S. sanctions on the oil industry, which led to more focus on other sectors. Much of this expansion is in large part made possible by linking research institutions with manufacturers. This step was critical for sharing knowledge in collaborative product development. Catalysts are the unsung heroes of the chemical reactions that make human society tick by. They help speed up chemical processes between molecules that might have been taken years to interact. Factories rely on catalysts to make everything from plastic to drugs. Catalysts also help process petroleum and coal into liquid fuels and are key players in clean energy technologies as well. However, their biggest use happens in the oil and gas industries.
This week, we're going to explore the expansive world of catalysts. We wanted to see who the major players in this field are and some of the applications of catalysts. Now we will uncover how these tiny but mighty substances have made massive contributions to the national economy. It's going to be a fun one, so let's start the show.
To familiarize ourselves with what catalysts are and where they are used, we visited a company specializing in making these items. Sarv Gas and Oil Company is a knowledge-based firm that has been active in this field for nearly two decades. This company makes a wide range of catalysts in 30 different types. Among its products, one can name catalysts used for the synthesis of formaldehyde, which is handy in the production of methanol. But that's not all. The products made here are extensively used to make raw materials with applications in numerous other production industries. Among its numerous achievements, this company has also obtained the know-how for making machinery and equipment necessary to complete various catalyst production chains. And that's not an easy task.
A lot of hard work and science goes into making catalysts. That is why not all catalysts are created equal. Some are made with lower quality depending on the means and production methods, because catalysts are used to make other items through chemical processes. Having good quality catalyst is crucial in making high quality final products.
This company serves two major roles: high-quality catalyst production and product development. As a knowledge-based company, the research and development department holds the pulse of these activities. It has dedicated much of its resources to furnishing its department with the latest technology to get the job done. Knowledgeable experts run its research and development department. Among its staff, this company employs engineers, scientists, researchers, and a whole host of other experts. Over the years, it has created hundreds of direct job opportunities as well. This company has overcome numerous obstacles to enjoy its many hard-earned achievements. One such challenge has been the U.S.-imposed sanctions. Some time ago, Catalyst were placed on the U.S. sanctions list, so this company stepped up to the plate to fill in the market void, turning a challenge into an opportunity. With nearly 20 years of experience under its belt, this company has gained significant ground in the market. It is also known for being one of the first businesses to export catalysts. As part of its future vision, it wants to manufacture machines and catalysts that will complete various domestic chain productions. Additionally, it strives to make Iran self-sufficient in the field of catalysts. Catalysts are broadly used to make metals. Powerhouse industries like Iran's steel and iron sectors rely heavily on catalysts for their outputs. Products from these industries are vital to downstream manufacturing sectors such as construction materials, cables, home appliances, and automobiles, just to name a few. All of these sectors are part of the process of adding value to materials that generate higher profits as well. Companies like the one we just mentioned play a big role in providing catalyst to the steel and iron industry. Based on figures from the World Steel Association, Iran is the world's 10th biggest steel producer. Last year, crude steel production stood at 27 million tons. That's in contrast to the year 2019, when the country produced over 30 million tons. But despite the apparent decline, Iran's world standing remains unchanged. Meanwhile, the government has implemented several plans to increase production in this key sector over the years. Industry participants expect Iran to climb to 7th place among global top steel producers by 2024. There are 30 active steel producers in the country with high production capacities. These companies receive most of the iron they need through domestic sponge iron producers. It might be interesting to know that Iran is the biggest producer of sponge iron in the West Asian region. That's going off of a recent report by the Iranian Mines and Mining Industries and Renovation Organization. The report also says Iran is globally ranked second in its productions, closely rivaling India at the top. Figures show that in 2020, domestic sponge iron production stood at 30 million tons, while India's was around 33 million.
As we mentioned earlier in the program, catalysts are necessary to make numerous items. That is why they are considered a strategic product. And in Iran, these pocket rockets play a significant role in the country's oil and petrochemical industry. Remarkably, without catalysts, Iran's thriving oil and gas industries would not thrive as they are today.
According to figures from the Oil Ministry, the country exported petrochemical and petroleum products worth around $20 billion in 2020. That is twice the value of Iran's crude exports. While most of the world's last refinery output during the coronavirus pandemic, Iranian gasoline exports rose in the year 2020. Going off of figures from the National Oil, Gas, and Petrochemical Products Exporters Union, exports hovered at 8 million tons that year. These gasoline exports generated an estimated $3 billion. Iran's oil and gas industry is still going strong, and there are many investment opportunities in this sector and its downstream industries.
All right, everyone, it's time for me to pass it over to my dear friend and colleague out there in the field who has prepared an interesting feature for you. Let's go check it out.
The foundation of knowledge-based companies is built on creating income from knowledge rather than natural resources. Firms involved in pharmaceuticals, health biotech, medical equipment, new materials, avionics, telecommunications, information technology, and software are considered to be in the knowledge-based industries. In this program, we are visiting a knowledge-based company that's involved in information technology. Most of the services that governments have to offer to people are in form of simple inquiries. In many of them, people have to make a payment. That includes bills, taxes, and whatnot. This company has managed to facilitate the process and design an online platform named Qabzino. The other group of services do not need payments. Those include checking your social security insurance records or your subsidy records. Such services are offered in another product named Pishkhan 24, which is an online government services counter. The company is also planning to introduce a new product for car-related services to the market in the coming months. This company has managed to expand despite sanctions and other problems. Customer satisfaction has built their trust, and this has been a great incentive for the company to work harder to design new products. They also plan to enter the market and are looking for strategic partners abroad. Their goal is to attract domestic and foreign investment.
Without further ado, let's dive right into some news and trends regarding the mining and construction industry. As the young population in Iran matures, many of them are ready to purchase their first home. This has caused a housing shortage in the country. In response, the government has been pursuing a plan to build over 2 million affordable housing units nationwide.
Presently, the government has secured land for this construction project, which is in its first phase. Earlier this month, the government put out a public call for the registration of people in need of housing. So far, around 2.3 million people have signed up for the program. Meanwhile, large domestic companies are also bidding to participate in the massive national project. The government created the National Housing Movement in response to an estimated 10 million housing unit deficit nationwide.
The National Housing Movement will bolster construction and its related manufacturing sectors, but it has also gained the attention of Belgian companies who are keen to cooperate on this project.
According to the Iran-Belgium Chamber of Commerce, these companies are active in the field of modern construction materials. They have shown interest in setting up factories in Iran for manufacturing building parts and will be bringing advanced technologies and investment as well. An official with the Chamber of Commerce explains that building parts will be manufactured off-site. Then, they will be transferred to projects and assembled into larger sections on-site. The official said, negotiations between Iran and Belgium regarding construction date back to 2008, but was never really followed up until this year.
For our last bit of news, let's take a look at the mining sector. Iran has launched its first ever mining and mining industries innovation center in a bid to further expand the sector and develop the necessary technology.
Several knowledge-based firms will be operating out of this center, and five startups have also joined. The goal is to acquire new technologies in the field of mining and geology. Officials expressed hope that this infrastructure will encourage research and innovation in this field.
And there you have it. That covers our program for today. Thanks for joining us and see you next time for more exciting market and industry analysis on Bozor.
فيلم فيخ از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asl zinde ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
A person who gets the permission can benefit more from his presence in a holy site like the holy shrine of an infallible. The late Shaykh Murtaza Ha'eri, one of the close friends of the late Imam Khomeini, loved Imam Reza's holy shrine very much. Whenever he found a chance, he went to pay a visit to the holy shrine of Imam Reza in Mashhad. He was dedicated to Imam Reza to the extent that even he swept and cleaned the courtyard of the holy shrine. Once when he was entering the holy shrine of Imam Reza, one of his relatives recognized him and went to him to greet. When he reached the Shaykh was so much busy with supplication and attention to the holy shrine that he couldn't greet him back warmly and gave the man a cold welcome. The man left, and the Shaykh wanted to enter the holy shrine when a great scholar saw him and said, "You may not be welcome today to the holy shrine because of your behavior with the man." Upon hearing this, the Shaykh got sad and left the holy shrine and asked for the man from his relatives. He went to him and asked for his forgiveness. The next morning, when he went to the holy shrine, he saw the great scholar at the entrance again, who told him, "This time, Imam Reza alayhi salam is happier with your entrance to his holy shrine." This incident shows that entering the holy shrine of an infallible has its own formal and divine etiquettes. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam led a life which was in balance and harmony with that of the Prophet Muhammad, his great-great-grandfather. His life and the life of Imam al-Kazim was in the line and the direction of the Prophet Muhammad. And of course, the life of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam was a strict adherence and obedience of Islam in so many different ways, whether it was his ethics, his morals, his behaviors, his actions, his statements. We find that Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the copy of the Holy Prophet Muhammad of Islam, the messenger of Allah. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam led an upright, righteous, and noble life. These are his dialogues.
Mm-hmm.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام: التودد إلى الناس نصف العقل.
Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, affection towards people is half of intellect.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. In the beautiful dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam with his companions, we find that in response to how we should supplicate to Allah, what we should say to Allah, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam speaks about this idea, and he teaches certain du'as, certain dialogues, certain forms and manners of communication to his companions on how to communicate and have a dialogue with the Almighty Allah. In one such instance, we find that Imam al-Kadhim teaches his companion to recite thus, O my protector, Allah, I have submitted to you, so do not hand me over to the enemy. I have trusted in you, so do not desert me. I have sought refuge in your vast and easy protection, so do not dismiss me. In this beautiful dua, very short, very concise, but so beautifully profound and full of spirituality and wisdom, Imam al-Kadhim addresses the Almighty Allah as, O my protector. What better protector can one have than Allah? And then how humbly does Imam al-Kadhim say, I have submitted to you, O Allah, so do not hand me over to the enemy. For surely if we submit ourselves to Allah, then we are of Allah. We are now the property of Allah. We are under the care and protection of Allah. So why would Allah hand us over to the enemy? And Imam al-Kadhim says, I have trusted in you, O Allah, so do not desert me. If we trust Allah, how is it possible that Allah will leave us alone, will leave us isolated, will leave us lonely, will desert us? And that too at the times when we need Allah the most. And finally, Imam al-Kadhim says, I have sought refuge in your vast and easy protection, so do not dismiss me from you. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Kadhim, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program Dialogue. I'm Attar, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I want you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Abbas Mirza about Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
So Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam is saying there are two hujjat. One is that aql, which is daruni, which is in us, that we have. And then there is aql, which is outside, which is the hujjat of God, which is the proof of God. Because there is a possibility of the internal aql being influenced from outside. The internal aql making an error. If that internal aql makes an error, then you have the imam outside. Because that is why qiyas in our school of thought is not considered as a valid methodology in jurisprudence. So therefore, qiyas is your opinion, your intellectual calculation, but there is hujjat, which is outside. Yes, Aql is one of the hujjat from those four. You have the Kitab, you have the Sunnah, you know, you have the Taqreer Masum, Qawl Masum, you have the Quran, right? And then Aql as well, and consensus, which is the Ijma. So Aql is one of them that is there. But if this Aql goes against the hujjat, it is not accepted. So you have the Aql Daruni, you have the Aql which is internal Aql, then you have the Aql which is outside. And both of them needs to be in harmony for reaching or for that plight towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The emphasis on intellect, the emphasis on knowledge, the emphasis on mannerism, on adab, that's what Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam, the Imams, promoted and showed in their akhlaq, in their behavior and approach things. That's why, you know, Imam is known as Kazim, who controlled that, who had hilm, which is one of the qualities of God, who had hilm. And at the same time, the empathy that the Imam had, where he took the suffering of his own self, you know, so that others may not suffer.
Listening to this episode of Dialogue, don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
In the limelight.
Just 2 weeks before the Zionist regime forces assassinated Palestinian-American journalist Shirin Abu Aghile, the International Federation of Journalists, the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate, and the International Center of Justice for Palestinians had submitted a formal complaint to the International Criminal Court accusing the Zionist regime of systematically targeting Palestinian journalists. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Marjorie Khan, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Journalists Accused Israeli Regime of Targeting Them 2 weeks before killing of Abu Aghile. Stay tuned for more. Just 2 weeks before the Zionist regime forces assassinated Palestinian-American journalist Shirin Abu Aghile, the International Federation of Journalists, the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate, and the International Center of Justice for Palestinians had submitted a formal complaint to the International Criminal Court accusing the Israeli regime of systematically targeting Palestinian journalists. The targeting of journalists and media organizations in Palestine violates the right to life and freedom of expression, said Anthony Belanger, the General Secretary of the International Federation of Journalists. In a moment when the Zionist regime propaganda machine is working hard to keep mainstream news organizations mired in reporting on the Zionist regime efforts to raise questions about who shot the bullet that killed Abu Aghile, we must insist on understanding her killing within the broader and ongoing context of the Zionist regime's violence against Palestinian journalists. A It was revealing that the Zionist regime's military spokesperson described Shirin and her colleague, Ali al-Samoudi, who was shot in the back, as being armed with cameras. If you will permit me to say that, writes James Zogby in The Nation. That is what good journalists do. They arm themselves with cameras and laptops. They witness events as they happen and tell stories so that readers and viewers can understand the human drama that is unfolding. It appears that Israel finds this profoundly, even existentially threatening. Why else would they have killed dozens of Palestinian journalists in the past 2 decades? It was perhaps no accident that the Zionist regime targeted Abu Aqil on May 11th, 4 days before Palestinians commemorated the 74-year anniversary of the Nakba, the Arabic word for catastrophe. On May 15th, Palestinians mourned the violent founding of the fabricated regime of Israel on Palestinian land. For 25 years, Abu Aqil had documented the Zionist regime's war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territory for Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera reported Abu Aqil herself embodied Palestinian humanity by speaking truth to power. She was covering an arrest operation by the Zionist regime forces near the entrance to the Jenin refugee camp when she was assassinated. Although she was wearing a flak vest marked press, an Israeli regime military sniper shot her below the ear. The only part of her head not covered by her protective helmet, clearly evidencing an intent to kill. Al Jazeera journalist Shata Hanaisha, also wearing a helmet and vest labeled as press, tried to reach Abu Aqil, but the Zionist regime troops did not stop firing even after she collapsed, she said. I couldn't even extend my arm to pull her because of the shots. The army was adamant on shooting to kill. Ali al-Samoudi, another journalist with Al Jazeera, who was also wearing a press vest, was shot in the back while covering the same event as Abu Aqil. He survived and is being treated for his wounds. Thousands of mourners came out to honor Abu Aqil. To add insult to injury, as her casket was being carried through the streets, the Zionist regime occupation forces attacked them, beating and kicking the mourners, then forcing pallbearers to nearby drop the coffin. Now, the occupying power has spoken back by shooting her in the head and attacking her mourners, a response that can only be classified as acute and multi-eared state savagery. In keeping with Israelis' modus operandi of refusing to let Palestinians live, die, or be buried in peace, writes Belen Fernandez at Al Jazeera. Assassinations or extrajudicial executions constitute war crimes under the Geneva Conventions. On March 3, 2021, Fatou Bensouda, the former ICC chief prosecutor, had announced that the ICC was mounting an investigation into war crimes committed in the West Bank, including East Al-Quds and the Gaza Strip, since the Zionist regime's 2014 Operation Protective Edge, during which the Zionist regime forces killed 2,251 Palestinians. Bensouda found a reasonable basis to believe that the Zionist regime forces committed war crimes, including willful killing, willfully causing serious injury, disproportionate use of force, and the transfer of Israelis into Palestinian territories. Bensouda also determined there was a reasonable basis to investigate war crimes, including intentional attacks against civilians using civilians as human shields and torture and willful killing by the Zionist regime forces. In October 2021, the Zionist regime designated six Palestinian human rights groups as terrorist organizations.